Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. Last week, we revisited the case of the Green River Killer in preparation for this week's exciting crossover episode slash event, my discussion with Nick Edwards, one half of the dynamic duo who hosts the popular podcast True Crime Garage. We discuss everything from how Gary Ridgway's childhood may have impacted his psychology to why it made it so darn hard to catch him. Well, thank you for joining me today, Nick. I'm really excited to have you.
Thanks for having me on the show. We met at CrimeCon last year and had very interesting conversation and found out that we have a strong interest in a very bad man.
We do.
And the conversation took off and we talked a lot and realized, you know what, we should probably schedule a talk for a future date because there's so much that we could talk about.
Definitely. For anyone that's listening that might not know your show, if they're living under a rock, why don't you introduce yourself and a little bit about your show, and then they'll go put it on their podcast app to listen to next.
So I am one of the hosts of a show called True Crime Garage. It's a weekly podcast, true crime podcast. Most of the time, I'd say that we specialize in cold case homicides, and we try to bring a new case to the listeners every single week. And we've been doing it since 2015, and we're over 700 episodes deep now. So it's been a long, strange trip.
Yeah, I'm one of your early listeners. You were one of the first shows I ever started listening to, and I remember telling everyone I knew about it. My co-host now, I made her go on a road trip with me and listen to you the whole time. And here we are now. So, you know, something that occurred to me when we were setting up this call was I don't really know how your podcast came to be. Do you have a little bit of background on how you and the captain made this true crime podcast happen?
Yes. So we live in central Ohio, and for a handful of years, he lived in the neighboring state of Indiana. And I was aware that he was moving back. And at the time, he and I both enjoyed talk radio from a young age, but then transitioned into podcasts. We were listening to podcasts back when you had to download them on your computer. So we're like, hey, let's do this podcast. We're both listening to podcasts, and we could do it. He has a background in recording engineering, so that made it easy. And I was a wannabe true crime author at the time. I was working on a book that I never finished that was no good to begin with. he said, you know, what's going to be our topic? Sports or something? And I said, you know, I've been working on this book of unsolved cases, and I'm not in love with it, but I think a couple of these chapters might make for a good podcast episode. So that was how we decided on True Crime Garage.
That's cool. I like that you know, now it happens a lot. We have people pairing episodes with alcohol, but I love how you guys do it with rating of bottle caps.
I know that we were the first to do that. So I feel like it's quite the compliment. And it's, as you said, it's rather common now. You know, it's you have people that do wine or bourbon or beer or what have you.
And so
milkshakes. And we kind of did it on accident. It was an excuse to hang out. And we were both working full-time jobs. And so I talk about that in my book a little bit, The Delphi Murders, where working 50, 60 hours a week and then driving to a garage to record our show at 7 o'clock at night after
you're gonna need a beer.
Yeah, you've worked 9-10 hours already. And I told the captain, I'm like, if there's no beer, I'm not doing the show. What I like to say is the beer was the midnight oil, and I was happy to burn it.
Yeah. No, I think it's good. And you guys were the first. I can count so many now, but I remember the first couple of shows that I thought were unique with it. And I still like it. So like you said, we met at CrimeCon and we got to talking about the Green River Killer. And I wondered what drew you to this case to have an episode on your podcast? I know you did a little Uniquely Impaired It with Ted Bundy, which we'll talk about a little later. But was it always one you wanted to cover?
From a storyteller perspective, he's a difficult one to talk about, right? Because he's not... While there are certainly interesting aspects to these crimes, he's not overly intriguing.
Like, yeah, he's not remarkable.
Exactly. And then on top of that, like, it really, when you talk about him and you feel the need to speak the names of his victims, and so many there were, it feels like telling that story just becomes like a list of victims' names. And so I had always wanted to cover the Green River Killer, just not feeling comfortable about the way to present it to an audience. And the way that I got interested in the Green River Killer, and that's what you and I spoke about, was we both shared a period in our lives where we were, I don't know that obsessed is the correct term, but we were both
intrigued
and really dialed into this idea of this killer that's lasted for so long undetected. They don't know who he is. And I had a good 2 years of my life where I was just looking for anything I could get my hands on to read and consume and listen to about the Green River Killer back before they knew who he was. And I became reserved to the idea that they were never going to catch him.
I definitely thought that too. I was pretty young, but I do recall it was the first case where I feel like there was so many things published about a person that they had no idea who he was. So many shows, movies, books, articles, and they're always around my house because my mom was very true crime obsessed. So I picked it up and I was just as intrigued. And, you know, I was early teens when he was finally caught, but it was a big deal.
Yeah,
definitely.
The way I got interested in the Green River Killer case was through Ted Bundy. And one of my favorite true crime books ever is The River Man by Robert Keppel, who I know we'll talk about today. But The River Man, Ted Bundy and I hunt for the Green River Killer. This book was one of several books that were published before Gary Ridgway was identified as the Green River Killer. The thing I love so much about this book is it's really focuses in on three cases that the late great Robert Keppel worked on. Mm-hmm. And the first being the Ted Bundy case. And back in those days, their investigation, interestingly enough, was actually called the Ted murders. That's what, before they even knew who Ted Bundy was or who was perpetrating these murders out in Washington, they were calling it the Ted murders.
I didn't know that, actually.
The location where he did the double event, some of the other persons at the park and at the lake that day had overheard somebody introducing themselves as Ted. And it was believed that at least one of the victims, it was overheard that he had approached them and introduced himself as Ted. So they didn't firmly believe that the guy they were looking for was truly a Ted, but that's how the investigation got its name, the Ted murders, because they wanted to find either a Ted or somebody that was using that alias. And Ted Bundy turned out to be Ted number 7, I believe. They created this huge database
of just Teds.
Well, it was really interesting because they had a bunch of criteria to get your name on that list as a suspect. This sounds quite antiquated today, but this was early when bringing a computer to investigation was a whole new thing. And Robert Keppel, the late great Robert Keppel, had the genius idea of, let's create a spreadsheet and we'll put all of our suspects on there. We're talking hundreds of suspects, and we're going to have different things. You know, if they drive a certain kind of car, you check a box. If their name is Ted, or we know that they've used the alias Ted, you check a box. And so you start checking all these boxes. And what they did was they prioritized their suspects based on how many boxes you checked off.
Yeah, I mean, that's like a manual algorithm right there. That's pretty cool.
Turns out Theodore Bundy was number 7 on their list. He had checked that many boxes. So there were, there were 6 guys that had checked more boxes than Theodore Bundy. And unfortunately, Robert Keppel never truly caught Ted Bundy because he takes off, right? He goes off to Utah and Colorado. But so the book, The River Man, it goes through the early stages of the Ted murders investigation as Keppel worked it. And then he was on that task force that was brought into Atlanta when the child killings were going on.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about that quite a bit. And I'm guessing that might be the first time that he crossed paths with John Douglas. And then they get into this when he returns after the Atlanta child killings case is all over with. They have this Green River killer that's active. And Ted Bundy was scared out of his mind of dying. And, you know, he was going to be executed in Florida. Florida was very happy to kill him. And if you look online and troll around online, you'll even see pictures of people that were that had made shirts and signs. They were hanging out. They were barbecuing out front of Rayford Prison in Florida there in celebration, knowing that they were going to electrocute Ted Bundy. And he was terrified of his execution date. And as he should be, I mean, he's got a first class ticket to a soul flight to hell. Right.
Yeah.
And so he was buying time. And one way he would buy time is he would offer him, oh, here's a murder that I did that I didn't tell you about. Here's some information about one of my cases that I'll tell you about.
But you gotta give me,
yes. And he was stringing them along, and he wrote a letter to the task force saying, hey, I think I have some insights and some information that may prove useful to your investigation. And Bundy called Gary Ridgway the River Man. So when we covered it on True Crime Garage, we were wrapping up our Ted Bundy coverage, and we talked about Gary Ridgway and the Green River Killer, how it kind of related to the task force and their involvement with Ted Bundy. And the task force was very smart, made up of several people. But one thing that they did was they used their conversations about the River Man or the Green River Killer with Ted Bundy to also gain insights and learn more about Ted Bundy as well.
Yeah, which is
that's all he was
smart.
Doing. Yeah, he was, you know, and I think it's kind of human nature, right? That a lot of us believe that most things are kind of relative. If I feel a certain way, I do a certain routine, other people probably feel the same and probably have the same routine. And so he projected a lot of his MO and thoughts that he had in his case and said that this is the kind of guy you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting is a lot of it was true, right? A lot of it was similar, which I find interesting. You know, it's, you mentioned we didn't want to get, you wanted a new angle on the Green River Killer. We did the same thing with Ted Bundy. We didn't want to do a traditional read through of his case. So instead we focused on the theory that his first victim was one of his neighbors, a little girl named Anne. And so that was when we talked to the author that wrote a book about it. And that was kind of our angle. So that's interesting that we kind of mirror each other in that sense, because we will dig into the Green River Killer on this episode. I covered it years ago very lightly because I interviewed a psychologist and that took up most of the episode. But I'm interested to dig into a little bit about this Ted Bundy stuff. So in 1984, King County developed a task force and he sent a letter, right? He sent a letter offering his assistance and helping them figure out who this guy was. What are the things that turned out to be true? One of them was, he was going to be close to home, right? The dump sites were going to be close to home, and they triangulated an area, and it was correct. Considering he would dump bodies in the forest, hard to find, some of them were never going to find, I think. What's your take on that?
Well, and you will see that with a lot of different serial killers where they have what they is often referred to as a comfort zone, and they will operate within that comfort zone, whether it be procuring the victim or disposing of the victim or murder weapon or what have you. But yeah, they often have a comfort zone. And what you, I think we see with somebody like Gary Ridgway is while he does possess the ability to adapt, he's also not overly creative. But what's terrifying And I hate to say it in such, to be sound so flip about it, but he was successful for so long. If it's not broke, don't fix it kind of thing. And
he
was in their file. His name was in the police file.
From the beginning.
Yeah.
One of the other things he said is he's probably revisiting these sites, whether it's a trophy to relive what he went through or he's engaging in necrophilia, which ended up to be true, right? But what I find such an anomaly about Gary Ridgway is he was so plain Jane type of a guy, blends in, small in stature, but he's an anomaly to me because he was doing things that were actually smart, like bringing other people's trash into the crime scene to throw them off, to waste time in the investigation. And I always wondered, was it purposeful? Was it an accident? Because his IQ wasn't very high from testing.
No, but you can see how with somebody like Gary that it consumes the thoughts that he has throughout the day and the entire day, right? He's got a lot. He may not be the smartest guy, but he had a lot of time to think about this and live inside his own world, live inside his own head, and think about ways to adapt, because he knew they were out. They were vocal about being out looking for. And this is one of those situations. Sometimes you don't know you have an active serial killer until he gets caught. And then you're, wait, this guy killed four people.
Yeah.
We thought we picked him up for one murder. He killed four or five people. Gary Ridgway's situation, they knew that they were looking for a serial offender, and he knew that they were looking for him. Very early on in this investigation, we know that there's an active serial killer. So that's different than some cases. And we know because they gave him the name, the Green River Killer, very early on, because that's where they were finding the bodies.
And that caused a problem for them, too. They, you know, here they're talking to Ted Bundy that he's revisiting his sites, and they come up with this great idea with his help to stake out those sites. But with the media so interested in a possible serial killer, that wasn't going to work out for them. And that's unfortunate, because that yet another time he could have been caught early. That may have worked, right?
Yeah. And one thing that I wish that I knew was he killing them, leaving them, and then placing them in the water at a later time? Because once they're in the water, it complicates revisiting your victim. But we do know the early victims were found in the river, and then he adapts and starts leaving them in the woods.
I never really wondered that, actually. I just assumed that was his first tactic and he switched, but maybe it wasn't. Maybe he was moving them, because a lot of those bodies were posed, taunting almost. So he could have been up for everything. And that's why I find him so interesting. I think why I kind of latched on to him as a serial killer as one of the more interesting ones, because at first you're like, what a boring guy. And you're like, I don't know. These crime scenes were intricate at times. His MO wasn't always pinned down. The tableaus he was posing, like, where'd he come up with that? Did he read about it somewhere?
The only good thing is, had he been doing this today, he would have been caught rather quickly.
Yeah.
The water certainly complicates your investigation and will destroy evidence. So that he had that working in his favor. Yeah. He was doing some, let's say, criminally sophisticated things like purposely bringing other people's trash. They say these jokes, you had to be there. And you have to wonder, like, did you have to be there to fully understand this? Because there was a lot of talk about, sex workers were afraid to get into guys' cars, and because the killings were happening. Well, but they were, they really, because they were still getting in cars, and they still got in Gary Ridgway's car. And we know that for fact. They've said that for years, and I've kind of always questioned that. And then but yeah, for him to go on for the amount of time that he did, and you're right, Ted Bundy says he's probably revisiting the murder scene or the body recovery scene. And we do know that he did do that on occasion. That's weird, because that's something that Ted Bundy was absolutely doing.
Oh, yeah.
To the point where he was applying makeup to them after they had decayed. And what's weird is that is a kind of a shared trait that goes all the way back to, you can trace set all the way back to John Norman Collins, the Michigan murders. That's how that was one of the ways that they got onto him. They had zero in the way of suspects in that case. And what they did was when they recovered one of the bodies, and I believe they attempted to do the same in the Green River case, but they found one of the bodies. You don't tell anybody. You don't tell the news. And you wait and you see if the guy's going to come back to the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've already covered, Gary, he adapted when they were onto him. He's a Green River killer. He's going to place their bodies in the Green River. And he goes, nope, no more. I'm going to place them in the woods.
In a new place.
Mm-hmm. Hell, he even went to Oregon at least two occasions that we know of, and suspected another two victims that he may have placed in another state.
Yeah. And Washington and Oregon are two of the largest states. They're very heavily wooded. Half the time we don't even find bodies until after a forest fire. For instance, we found several bodies after a recent forest fire that had been missing for years. People always ask, why are there so many serial killers in the Pacific Northwest? That's definitely a reason. It's a big, big place where bodies can hide, and it's not so easy to stumble upon them. And I know you guys talked about this in your podcast episode. There was a break when the task force wasn't finding bodies. And they're like, oh, maybe he's done. He's done killing. No, he's not done killing. Just can't find him now.
Can't find him. And he did have a period too when he was in love, right? Yeah. And prevented him from, he wasn't so excited to go out and kill during a period of, I believe it was his second marriage or his third marriage? But I think it was his third marriage.
Wasn't the second one the one he wanted to kill?
Yeah.
Or he wished he would have killed.
And he even said that on occasion he felt like killing a sex worker was him acting out killing his second wife.
Yeah. Let's dig in more to why he got away with it for so long. I know we mentioned early on he was questioned. I read about how he actually had scratch marks on his arm from one of the victims, Marie Melvar. And he was being interviewed by police and hit his arm up against a fence he was leaning on, and then burnt it with battery acid after to kind of hide it. So, I mean, that's forethought.
Yeah.
He also got through a positive polygraph, which, you know, polygraphs don't mean anything, but that's impressive.
You know, there's that old school of thought that, oh, the psychology of a serial killer. Underneath all of it, if you go deep enough, that on some level they want to get caught. But every killer that I've reviewed thus far on True Crime Garage, they went to great efforts to not get caught. I don't think that psychology is, let's debunk that right now, because I don't think it's true. I mean, Gary Ridgway was spoke to by police on more than one occasion, interviewed. As you pointed out, he passes the polygraph exam, and we're sitting here all these years later, and we got the Colonial Parkway murders case that mm-hmm. they're having some successes there, closing out a couple of the cases. But we now know that the man that was absolutely responsible for at least two of the murders in the Colonial Parkway series, he was their prime suspect for a period of time, but they cleared him because he passed the polygraph. And, you know, John Douglas, I believe it's in Mindhunter or one of his earlier books, but he spends a good deal of time educating the public about these polygraph exams. And he's saying, look, it's still a good tool. Don't throw it out the window. We should still use it. And I'll tell you why people always go, well, Nick, if you say all these bad things about polygraphs and how they don't work, and then you're going to say you still use them. And here's why you still use them. If you got 10 guys that you think may have done something, and nine of them raise their hand and say, yeah, I'll take your polygraph test, the one guy that didn't raise his hand, he should move up your suspect list. You can use it to sort out. But see, a true psychopath will feel no remorse,
mm-hmm.
and not just not feel remorse, will enjoy what he has done.
There's no nervousness.
He's not nervous about mm-hmm. being hooked up to it. Yeah, he doesn't want to get caught. He doesn't feel anything for taking that life.
He also believes he won't get caught. I think that there's a confidence there, right? That they're smarter than everyone else.
And on the flip of that is you can get a false lead because Douglas points out that if you have a husband or a mother or a father that, you know, if their child is killed or if their spouse is killed, they may register emotion. You know, they might hit that marker on certain questions because they feel, even though they weren't responsible for the murder, they feel guilt for not being able to protect their loved one. They feel some responsibility for what happened to their loved one. So you can get false indicators there as well. And it would be interesting to see and to know 100% what they did with that information when Gary passed the polygraph. Did they clear him like they did in the Colonial Parkways case, or did he end up on a different list? But we do know he is a person of interest to them. But at the same time, when sex workers are being killed, their persons of interest are, you're going to start with any Johns that you have, anybody that's been picked up in the time frame that you're looking at for trying to pick up a sex worker.
Well, and unfortunately, at the time, there were several killers who were targeting that same population. And, you know, a lot of the details in the story we hear over and over. You know, you talked earlier about, oh, they were scared to get in a car with him, but they still did it. That happens all the time. You got to work. They need money. Some of them had addictions they're feeding where they're not putting themselves first. But what I found really interesting that I picked up on a very early movie, it was maybe like early 2000s, terrible movie about this case. But one thing they covered well is they started asking, show me your ID, because they knew there was a serial killer targeting people like them. But he would open it and there would be a photo of his son and he'd cover up his name and they'd be like, oh, he's a family guy. I can get in with him. He doesn't look too big. He's not scary. So he was, you know, still tricking people and eluding them by giving this persona of this family guy, which I just, it's so creepy.
Yeah. Yeah. Purposely making it so that he would accidentally show a picture of his son. Like,
yeah, or toys in his car.
Didn't mean to do that. Yeah. He'd leave toys in his vehicle. Mm-hmm.
With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom or the motherly figure in your life? Let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your recipient a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about, for example, your mom's life or any custom questions that you want to ask. And then she can either type her response or record her voice. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories forever. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Obviously, we love anything surrounding storytelling. It's what we do. So to be able to gift this to my mom, to not only hear her stories, but the stories of my grandparents and other family members, it will create a cherished gift for all of us to enjoy. Check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code RAIN for 10% off today.
You know, back to him adapting with body placement. And do you know, I know that for a period of time, you had serial killers that were active in Oregon as well. Do we know, do we think that he was placing some of the bodies there to make police either think that this other serial killer is traveling, they're one and the same?
Yeah, I think so. There are several bodies that they weren't sure who was the cause of it, what serial killer it was, because the MOs were so similar. The name is eluding me off the top of my head. I recently covered a case with a guy here in Oregon. Same thing. He would troll for sex workers. He'd take them out to the woods where he would attack them. But he would do a lot of dismemberment and things that Ridgway wasn't doing, but they were still confused. They're like, well, this is probably a Green River Killer body because it just makes sense, you know? So that it, sometimes I wonder, like, does he even know which ones the people he killed? Because, you know, he's saying he can't remember half of them. He thinks it's over 100 people. He may be confusing some of these other killers' bodies of his own, too.
And I hate to say this, but I kind of believe him. I kind of believe is it convenient that he can't remember? Maybe. But
or was it that many?
It's just so many people.
I mean, 3-4 a month.
You have other killers where they can name everybody and but it's also what is the relationship between the killer and the victim. And for mm-hmm. Gary, it was that relationship was a 10-minute car ride. And that's pretty much all it was. And we talk about him adapting. One thing he did on several occasions when he knew the police were out and they were monitoring, surveilling the area, there were times where, you know, he says, I can't remember exactly how many people I killed, who I killed, where I left all of them. But he does say, you know, I let so many of them go. I don't know percentage wise how many he let go. I feel like that's a bit of a stretch. I don't think he let so many of them go. I think that he let them go when he thought either A, this person's going to be difficult for what I'm trying to do for mm-hmm. any number of reasons. B, we do know that on a couple occasions he thought that somebody spotted the girl getting into or the woman getting into his car, and actually girls appropriate too, because we do know that some of these victims unfortunately were young and
they were runaways.
Mm-hmm. And so on some occasions, if he thought that people were paying particular interest to him picking up somebody, he would purposely drop them back off. So, of course I'm not the killer. I just returned her back to the spot where I picked her up from.
Yeah. And I think he learned that early on too, because in one of the early murders, somebody had witnessed him as one of the last people to be seen with the victim. And that's why police were talking to him in the first place. So, you know, he learned early on, well, if there's going to be an eyewitness, I probably need to cover my bases, which is smart. Or, you know, maybe they are a little unwieldy, like he couldn't get his arms around him. There are plenty of victims who fought back really hard and were able to get away even after being hurt severely by someone, like in the case I recently covered. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to like put your finger on this guy because he just switched it up so easily. He also changed his car so often to get away with it too. You know, he wasn't driving what he was driving before when a witness saw him.
He's another one. A lot of these guys, their vehicle is every bit as much of their arsenal. You know, it's one of their weapons. It's one of their killing tools, if you will. And we know it with Bundy, with Gary Ridgway, with so many of these guys. And yeah, he needed to change cars frequently because he was using the vehicle to procure to find a victim.
Yeah.
And he's using the vehicle in some cases to transport the bodies. You know, because some of these women he killed at his home. And that's a weird thing, too, that like because there was this uneasiness in the streets and everybody knew that there was a killer that's preying on women in the area. Some of the women were, where are we going? You know, if I do get in your car, where are we going to go? Oh, mm-hmm. we're going to go out in the woods. No, I'm not good with that. Or we're going to go to my house. Oh, no, I'm not. Some wouldn't be good with that either. You know, so right. He had multiple locations and some of them just in his vehicle. One thing I'm shocked, Emily, is that they're watching. They're looking for this guy, particularly late at night, midnight, 1 a.m. They're out trolling the streets like, oh, we're going to see a woman get into a car. We're going to find her a few days later. We're going to write down license plates and descriptions of vehicles that we see these women getting into, and we'll catch them eventually. But most of these women, he's picking them up in the early morning hours. He's likely out there 2-4 hours after the police are done for the night, after they're done writing down license plates for the night.
Yeah, it's an interesting stereotype to think the bad guy is lurking at night, and that isn't the case. That's, again, how you could elude it for so long. We saw the same thing with it's the Malala Forest Killer is the one that very similar. He would pick up sex workers and he'd take them to the woods and leave their bodies. same thing, you know, police would go out and they would try to talk to these women to warn them. But at the time in the 80s, the relationship between sex workers and police was not great, right? They tried really hard to bridge that gap, but it was looked down upon and frowned upon, and they were getting arrested and charged with things that no one wanted to interact with them. So I don't know if their efforts kind of went unappreciated in that sense. Because a lot of the media coverage too is like convicted prostitute or so. It's like, wow.
Well, and you know, there's no nice way to put this or to sugarcoat it, but even when they show some of the pictures of the victims, right? And it's like, oh, this is from a booking photo from 2 years ago. You know, or the person. And as we said, many of his victims were drug addicts. And that doesn't mean that they're any less of a person than you or I. But yeah, there is a certain stigmatism that goes along with that kind of. And truly, that is what Gary told us. Like, Gary tells us in the simplest form, like, why are you who you are? Why did you do what you did and how did you do it? And it's in its simplest form, he tells us, I hated women. I wanted to kill everyone. He didn't just want to go kill sex workers. He says everyone. Inside, he wanted to kill every woman.
Wow.
And he chose sex workers because they were the ones that would get into his car.
Vulnerable. They're vulnerable people who may not be missed or may not even be noticed that they're gone.
It's as simple as that. I want to kill millions or billions of women. The ones that will get in my car are, I can pull up to a street corner and Wendy, she'll jump right in my car.
And look at how many women he did kill. I mean, he was successful at what he was doing. It's horrible that we probably won't know all their names or find all their bodies. I mean, there's been a lot of progress made in identifying some of them recently, which we can talk about. But, you know, it's interesting you bring up the hating women. Looking at his childhood, he is such like a stereotypical why he would grow up to hate women from what he's told his psychologists. And, you know, it spans from the traditional bedwetting to a teenage year. He claims when he would do that, his mom would wash his genitals and she would dress provocatively when she did that. And that made him want to kill her.
Let me slip into my genital washing outfit. But no, I don't know about, and you're right, that's stuff that he has said, and they've really tried to dive into that. And you always, you know, you always want to figure out nature versus nurture. Mm. I think from what my eyes tell me and my mind says is that, having reviewed so many of these different killers, is that I think it's a combination of the both. With Gary, there are some that I'm convinced were just born evil, and Gary falls into that category. Like, I don't know how much nature or his surroundings or the people involved in his young years contributed to him.
The nurturing. Yeah. As I wonder, like, I actually don't know this off the top of my head. I should look into it. Were his siblings interviewed on their thoughts of their childhood? Do they have the same reflections of their mother being like that? Or was he the only one in his family like that? You know, he stabbed a 6-year-old boy when he was a teenager. Like, that's a red flag. Were his siblings awful too, or were they normal? Because I don't know. I bet they were.
From the videotaped interviews I've seen with him that he gave to police and FBI, he seems to speak very matter-of-factly, right? He doesn't mm-hmm. seem overly excitable about telling, you know, where you see somebody like BTK, Dennis Rader, who almost seems like, oh, finally I get to tell somebody, and I'm bragging about what I did. Where Gary Ridgway seems very matter of fact. And so it makes me, that part of me wants to go, okay, well, he's not embellishing. He's not trying to blame this on mom, or he's not trying to blame this on child abuse or anything of that nature. But then you have to remind yourself, well, he killed for so many years, and he was, you can't just be a killer. You have to be a liar every day of your life during that period. And he did it for so many years. Does he now just possess the ability, having done it for so long, lied to everybody for so long, that he can just sit and lie and look as if he's telling the truth? undetectable, just like the polygraph exam said.
Yeah. I mean, some people are very gifted at that and it's totally normalized into their day-to-day life. And, you know, we'd never know.
He didn't really have an undoing either, which is different than a lot of serial killers. Like you mentioned the Malala killer, right? Mm-hmm. His undoing was his massive drug use, right? This guy was just drunk all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Drunk all the time. He gets detected because he's drunk all the time and some drug use. And so he's sloppy. Joel Rifkin, who we mentioned in our notes, you know, we traded a couple notes back and forth, and some people consider him a bit of a copycat from Gary Ridgway. He's out in the New York area. He gets caught because he's just incredibly lazy. Like he's like the laziest serial killer I've ever reviewed.
He's like, I want to aspire to be like this guy, but...
And Ted Bundy, he was so addicted to the murder, the rape and murder part of what he was doing, that he really went on this downward spiral out of control. Like he stopped being careful about how he would get his victims. He stopped being careful about covering up his crimes. And he was
You guys described it as more of like a rampage at the end, right? Like.
Yeah, so some of the experts would say that's a frenzy, like a frenzy killer. And he started off very meticulous, and then he spiraled out of control into this frenzy type of killer. And Gary Ridgway never really seemed to have any of that. Like he got close to getting caught, or he was under police radar from time to time, but he doesn't have the excessive drug use. He doesn't seem to, we say not a frenzy type, because even when he's killing 2-3 a month, it's still he's following his script and he's sticking to the script.
I think where he's different is, you know, you see these cooling off periods with most of these killers. He was pretty consistently killing people for all these years, despite that one marriage. So I feel like it was so normal for him to be thinking about. I mean, that's almost every week, really. Like, that's insane. I don't know who has the time for that.
Well, he would tell the wife, hey, I got to go into work early on Thursday or Friday. And he would get up insanely early, right? Like 3 in the morning and claim that he's driving into work. He's out trolling for someone to get into his vehicle and he's raping and killing and then going off to work and going about his day. I believe that this was like the Zodiac was playing a game, right? And the Zodiac, one of the things that they reveled in was the idea that, oh, everybody wants to know who the Zodiac is. And I have that secret. I think one thing that Gary didn't tell us, I think Gary really got off on the idea that he's this killer. Everybody's looking for him. He's got this big, huge secret. He's the only one that knows the answer to this secret.
Right.
He's the only one that knows. And the reason why I say that is he did little silly things that would put him at a higher risk. Like he would take things from the victims and then gift them to a lady at work or to his wife or to a neighbor, or, you know, oh, here's some costume jewelry, or here's a scarf, or here's this item.
Right.
He claims that he even sold some of the victims' things at garage sales from his house.
Like shoes and things.
And I think he loved that idea of like, oh, I gave this woman a bracelet at work. And when she walked away with a big smile on her face, and if she only knew where that came from.
And then every time he sees it, he's thinking about what he did. And
yep.
Ugh. Yeah, it's taking the trophy collection to a whole new level because you're seeing other people wearing it and showing it off and they have no idea.
The other thing, too, is the surroundings, right? Like, so he got so used to picking up a woman, taking them out into the woods, into a wooded area, parking his for most of the time he was driving a truck, isn't that right? Like a pickup truck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he'd take him, get out of the truck and go off into the woods. But I read one of the books, I think this was his wife, one of his wife's, I think, contributed to a book that I read years ago. I might be mistaking it. Yeah, no, the Biography of an Unsuspecting Wife.
Oh, I don't know that one.
In that book, one of the things that I had learned was that one of the bedrooms in his house, and I think this was when they had met and started dating, was wallpapered to look like you were in the forest.
Oh.
And so that's so weird too. But then she says, she also says when we first started dating, his house had no carpet. And
I wonder why.
Yeah. The detectives are like, well, yeah, we think he was probably rolling victims up at the house and then removing them. And that's why he had no carpet. And we do learn some things from her base. And she says, look, I never even suspected him. But one thing that was helpful for Gary, she says, I didn't even know that there was a serial killer in the area. Because
wow.
She's like, I don't watch the news. I don't read newspapers. So I had no clue that there was
talking about it at work or anything.
She has no clue that there's a serial killer active in her city. And meanwhile, he's sharing a bed with her the whole time. They're living together in this house.
I mean, that's pretty common. I think that people don't suspect them. I mean, look at Jerry Brudos here in Oregon as well. His wife had no idea he was doing it in his garage right next door. She just wasn't allowed in there. And she was like, okay, that's fine. Meanwhile, he had a woman hung up in his garage for an entire 2 days and a car crashed into it. And the police were there and didn't even see her. I mean, it happens. And they have that in common, I think. They hide their secret lives well.
And of course, he had the two failed marriages, but he was still married at the time that he was picked up. And in fact, he started killing a lot less during that third marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Rader said, you know, life gets in the way. That's what he, you know, he when he was finally picked up, he says, you know, and his undoing was that he wanted the recognition. He wanted the credit for these horrible crimes that he thought, oh, they're going to think I'm so brilliant because I went undetected and I for so long. And I'm so on some deep level, maybe he wanted to get caught because that's the only way he's going to get the recognition that he
maybe
wanted.
He might be giving him too much credit there. I think, I mean, God, that's such a beautiful case of like criminal stupidity where they used it against him, his need for the spotlight, you know. I love that one. But I mean, same thing. He did blend in for years. Now, he had quite a period of time where he wasn't killing, right? That's why it was so hard to catch him, I feel like.
Yeah. But he says, he claims, I never truly stopped. I was always out.
Oh.
I was always out watching. He called them projects. He was like, I always had projects. I just didn't kill all of my projects. In fact, he says, I didn't kill most of my projects. But he said, I was always trolling and always working on these little secret projects, but life got in the way. I had kids. I had, you know, obligations. I had a wife. I had bills to pay, things of that nature. And you see that while Gary's frequency rarely dipped, you do see that with his third marriage, that there's a lot less killing going on during the course of his third marriage.
Right. So one of the things that's been really exciting since I think both of us recorded our earlier episodes on the Green River Killer is three of the unknown victims have finally been identified in the last 2 years. What do you think about that? I mean, it's one of those things I really love talking about genetic genealogy and how it's helped in identifying people. Do you guys talk a lot about that on your show in recent years since so many people have been identified thanks to it?
We do. And, you know, we're living in the golden age of solving these crimes, right? Mm-hmm. And we're very lucky for that you turn on the TV or find out on some website that, it seems like every couple of weeks that they're like 30-year murder solved, 40-year-old case solved. And then when we have somebody like the Green River Killer, you know, we got some people suspect he might be up to 90 plus murders.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he was convicted of 49. And of those 49, I think we've identified most of them by this time. But that if he is responsible for 90 plus, that's a huge gap between 49 and 91 or 95.
Yeah, I saw quite a list of likely missing persons and unidentified bodies that they think he's probably to blame for. It's so hard to imagine we may not discover some of these bodies that he is to blame for. Like I hope we do, but with how long it's been and how big our forests are here. I wonder if that's going to be the case. But it is interesting that so many have been identified recently. One of the gals that was identified, they actually found her remains in two different places. So she was identified in the 80s as one of his victims due to dental records. But then they had another set of remains that they weren't sure who they were. And in 2022, they were able to identify it. That's, I think it was Bones 17 was identified as Lori Ann Resbonik, I think is her last name. So she was 15. So that's interesting. I don't know. Does that count as two of the 49 bodies or just one, 48?
They're not exactly sure when she was killed. Obviously, the only date they have is when she's found. And so with her being so young and not knowing, you know, you're out there living on the streets, some of these individuals, and yeah. It's not like they have a calendar to keep some of them. You know, for some of these poor victims, it's wake up, make some money so I can get my fix, and then rinse and repeat, right?
Yep.
And you do the same thing day after day after day. So she had been a runaway and had been gone and on the streets for long enough that there's nobody coming forward saying, I remember the last time I saw her. So when you look her up, she's one that some lists, they have her listed as 15, some lists, they have her listed as 16, and some will specify that she was either 15 or 16 because we do not know the date that she was killed or last seen.
Yeah.
So yeah, she's included on the list that I'm looking at has 48 names. And then there were, I think, at least four or five victims that the task force did not attribute to as part of the Green River case until after Gary is picked up, identified, arrested, and confessing to these murders.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he took them through as many as he could remember, which I don't want to say it's commendable, but I mean, he didn't have to, right? He could have just taken the death penalty, which would have been commuted anyway. Not everyone would do that. We look at Ted Bundy, like you said, breadcrumbing his victims, and we, again, won't ever know them all. So I do appreciate that he gave as many details as he could, but I feel like he left out a lot.
And you're absolutely right. When you have somebody like Ridgway, who is, they're not even, yeah, he's confessed, but they're not even 100% sure how long he was active, right? Because he's picked up, he's apprehended in late 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And the confirmed kills, he's active between 82 and 98. But like you pointed out with Ted Bundy, do we really know the first victim, and do we really know the last victim? And in Gary's case, between 82 and 98, we know we had other serial killers that were active in this area at different times. I think Robert Lee Yates,
yeah.
I believe would have been.
Yeah. In
one
Washington
of them.
As well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so, you know, it gets really difficult. And then on top of that, that's something where, you know, I always say that you know, who gets lucky in these cases? The killer. The victims never get lucky. The only victims that got lucky were the ones that get away.
Right.
Right. And so the killer is the only one that stands to get lucky. And you see some of these cases where it's just a matter of happenstance that there's another active individual out there that's got to be mucking up the investigation for these investigators in some form or fashion. You know, we saw that with Ed Kemper down in California when he was active. There was two other serial killers that were
yep.
active. And Gary's, you had said two. I remember Yates being a person. I remember when they caught Yates, and I was like, how the hell is this guy not the Green River Killer? Right. Like,
I know.
I was like, this has got to be him. This has got
to be. What blew
him.
My mind too is he was getting accused of murders he didn't do, which were by another serial killer in the same area. We did an episode on that, and they're like, oh, wait, he was in Germany at the time. He couldn't have done this.
Right.
He was in the military. I mean, there were so many active in the 80s. So it's hard to know, you know, if we do come across some remains, it's especially with strangulation, it's hard to know.
And Gary's never getting out of prison. I feel confident saying that. He's 74. So if there is more to learn from him, I'm hoping that we, you know, let's get on that ball and start learning sooner rather than later.
Yeah, maybe he'll want to share in his remaining days. We can only hope.
And one thing that intrigues me about Gary is, who were you? What did you do and why did you do it? And it's, I hated women. I wanted to kill them all. I chose sex workers because they were the ones that would get in my car. I've never heard it put so matter of fact and so in such a simple form that's easy to digest for the rest of us, because it's really difficult for a normal person to try to crawl inside the heads of these guys. You know, they call it psycho for a reason. Yeah. So it's very difficult for you and I to try to analyze and figure out why did somebody do what they did and how they did it. And there is a lot that can be learned from somebody like Gary. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people talk about numbers too, right? The number of victims, and maybe that's important to some and maybe it's not to others, but I never really got that vibe from Ridgway that he particularly cared about having this great astronomical number of victims. Yeah. I think it was an addiction.
Like a habit. Yeah, a habit. And it was just ingrained into his life, right? Like, once you're doing something regularly, you want to keep doing it.
This is something that I fantasize about constantly. Mm-hmm. And once he decided to start acting out that fantasy, it was, he was needed it every few days, every mm-hmm. couple of weeks. And I think that's truly, he wasn't playing a numbers game like some have suggested. I think it was just, it, unfortunately, in such a bizarre thing to think about, it became a part of his everyday life.
It really did. You know, it's funny when you say that, how matter of fact he was, it reminds me of Wesley Allen Dodd. He's the child killer from Washington. He was the same way, very like straightforward, answer all their questions. He didn't try to lie about it. I mean, he's like, I am what I am. And if you don't put me in jail, I'm going to keep doing it.
One thing that I've always wanted to track down, and I know that it was out there at one time, and Wesley Allen Dodd, not just matter of fact, he wrote
diary. Yeah, he diaried it all. Mm-hmm. It,
well, he had the diary, but he also, he put together some kind of like how to keep your children safe.
Yeah, it was a book. He wrote a book. It was, we talked about, I did an episode about him.
Have you, have you viewed that book? I've always wanted to find that book. Like,
I haven't, I think I saw a couple of screenshots or a couple of images of just a few pages, but I haven't. You know who might is, Gary Brocato. He's the psychologist I interviewed. He was at CrimeCon as well. He collects stuff like that. So I wonder if he knows.
I know it sounds sick, but I've always wanted to track that down and read how Wesley Allen Dodd.
Interesting as well, is like he was,
because he was taking children.
Yeah. And he's like, this is how you can keep people like me from getting your child. But we got a lot of feedback on like, how dare you explore him as someone with like remorse who's trying to help. And I'm like, well, what do you call it? He didn't have to write it. You know?
And he was a weird one, because he did actually exhibit, who knows what he truly thinks and feels, but I would say he's one that would exhibit remorse. Like he would cry, and he would, yeah, you know, he
asked for the death penalty.
Yeah. And it felt like, and I know that on some of, in some of his diary, he's talking about how do I stop this? How do I change who I am? And I don't want to be like this. But then other times he completely enjoyed doing what he was doing. And you saw that too with somebody like Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, very mm-hmm. early on, he's trying to run from this, you know, on Dexter, they call it the dark passenger, right?
I love that show.
I'm trying to think of what Dennis Rader had a name for his as well. But, you wonder how much of that is real to them. You know, can I get away from this?
Yeah.
You know, we talked about there was a serial killer that did. He walked into a police station and said, I've killed four people. I'm the guy that you're looking for, you know, but oftentimes that's not what we see. Oftentimes what we see is somebody like Gary Ridgway, who's going to kill and kill and kill again until the day he is caught or is killed.
Yep.
And I really think that even though he had slowed down, had they never caught Gary Ridgway, I think he would have been killing up until his last days.
I think you're right. So, hey, if you're up for it, next time I do a serial killer case, maybe you can come back on and we can talk about it. I seem to know a lot.
I had a great time and I would love to.
Perfect. That sounds good. I'll let you know. Thank you so much, Nick. It was great to have you.
Yep. Have a great day.
You too. I'll talk to you soon.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.